The next case is 08-762, Cuyahoga County Bar Association versus Marcus Poole. Ms. Harris.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice and distinguished members of the court, may it please the court. I am E. Yvonne Harris, and I, along with my co-counsel, Reginald Maxton, represent the respondent, Marcus L. Poole. We filed objections to the board's recommendations. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of our time for rebuttal.
Okay, watch your time there.
As this panel is well aware, the primary purpose of the disciplinary process is not to punish the attorney, but to protect the public. The main thrust of our argument, as stated in our brief and in my anticipated discussions here with you today, is primarily to contest the Board of Commissioners and Grievances and Discipline recommendation of sanctions for my client, Mr. Poole. The board recommended a sanction of 24 months with 18 months stayed, plus 18 additional months of probation. We feel this punishment to be excessive, taking the facts and circumstances of this case into consideration. We are all aware that in determining the appropriate sanctions to impose for attorney misconduct, the court considers the duties that were violated, the actual or potential injury caused, the attorney's mental state, the existence of aggravating or mitigating circumstances, and also other similar cases. Mr. Poole had previously admitted and stipulated to each and every disciplinary violation that the board found him guilty of, with the exception of two, one being DR 1-102A4, engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Although the board did state that they would make it only an aggravating circumstance, we find this unacceptable, as there was no clear and convincing evidence presented to the panel to justify the position that they took. In reviewing the board's reasoning, we can only speculate that because Mr. Poole stated that he had a file, which he did, and that there were no notes taken in the file, and the fact that there were no notes taken evidencing his conversation with an individual named Mr. Cameron, and also doing the research, which he stated under oath that he did, we can only speculate that that is the reason that the board said that there was fraud or deceit. There was no evidence contrary to that, though, interestingly enough. We feel that this should not be used as an aggravating factor. I want to let this panel know that it is paramount to my discussions for you to know that Mr. Poole is extremely remorseful for all of his actions. In fact, it was included as a stipulation number 34. He acknowledges his lapses in judgment. He attempted to rectify them by completely reimbursing the two clients their refunds, $200 to Ms. Crawford and $1,000 to Ms. Thompson, and assures this panel of justices that he is taking proactive steps to assure that this will never happen again. This was an aberration brought on by mitigating circumstances. In this particular case, Your Honors, the punishment does not fit the crime. To begin with the factual history, Mr. Poole met Ms. Crawford sometime in 2004. And he actually, let me back up, he never met Dolores Crawford. he knew her daughter, Brenda Crawford, and she gave him $200 to file a motion for judicial release for one of her relatives who was in jail. Mr. Poole was one of Dana Crawford's original attorneys in the criminal matter. Mr. Poole then determined that some research, as well as consulting with the judge on the original matter, that Mr. Crawford, that he was not indeed entitled to the judicial release. But because a motion for judicial release was never filed, Ms. Crawford filed a complaint with the Bar Association, and it was referred to the fee dispute section. Unfortunately, Mr. Poole never responded to the letters of inquiry from the Fee Dispute Committee. At the time of inquiry, and this is, again, one of his mitigating circumstances, at the time of inquiry, he was one of the primary caretakers for his mother, who was at the time suffering from Alzheimer's and another debilitating illness. She eventually died from it on March 12, 2006. It is also noteworthy to mention that it was stipulated to by the relator and the respondent in stipulation number 23 that, quote, respondent's conduct did not prejudice or damage Dolores Crawford in violation of DR 7-101A3. Again, Mr. Poole still takes full responsibility for his behavior. With regard to the second case, that also could be classified as a fee dispute. Mr. Poole was retained by Nicole Thompson on a predatory lending matter. Mr. Poole acknowledged, like I said, doing some research on Ms. Thompson's case, but he does admit to not filing the lawsuit as directed. He admitted that in both his deposition and trial transcripts that he had sincere remorse for not completing her case. And she was, you will hear from the relator, that he didn't timely refund her money, but he did refund every penny of the $1,000 that she gave him. Also important is that there were no statute of limitation problems, so she was able to theoretically get another attorney timely.
Ms. Harris, could I ask, I know that the material that we have from the board, looking at mitigation and aggravation, states that the respondent was not registered to practice in the state of Ohio, and it does tell us that he's been a lawyer since 1978. Was he admitted to Ohio in 1978?
Oh, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And it was a matter of not paying the registration fee for...
Exactly.
For what period of time was he not registered?
Only until right after the hearing. The hearing was in November, so he didn't go past that December deadline where we are summarily, we can't practice. So he, in September, as all the justices on the court know, that we are required to pay that $350. He didn't pay it by September, but it was paid before December. So he still, as we all know, could practice. He just wasn't licensed to practice. And yes, he did pay it prior to the December where he could not practice.
Thank you.
Mr. Poole, and I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor, is a 30-year veteran of the legal community. He has been licensed to practice for 30 years, actually this year, and has not had a single disciplinary sanction against him prior to this time. And I think that is extremely meritorious, considering that he is a solo practitioner. And in my cursory research, it appears that solo practitioners appear to be the people who are sanctioned most often for obvious reasons, because of lack of funds, lack of support staff. And in my humble opinion, it shouldn't be like that. Solo practitioners, me being one of them, are really the foot soldiers of the legal community. We are the ones who every day face real people with real problems, and oftentimes on a pro bono basis, and not because we're trying to impress partners and things like that, it's because of the sheer necessity of it.
Ms. Harris, on that point, now and then we see, as we do here in the stipulations, a suggestion in the mitigation considerations that respondent serves a population which has difficulty securing legal representation. This is a mitigating factor. Can you explain? I've always been a little troubled by that, because one can assume from that certain populations, we should be easier on lawyers who serve certain populations, easier with respect to their compliance with our discipline rules, mm-hmm. because they serve a population that perhaps does not have easy access, either economically or just physically access to lawyers. Can you help me understand? I mean, I understand why it's said, but I'd be glad to, Your Honor.
Let me tell you the reality of a solo practitioner as opposed to a practitioner with a big firm. If we were to get a retainer, let's say for a divorce of $1,200, and we are serving someone in the underserved community, and let's say we bill $150 an hour, and the case, in reality, I've been practicing domestic relations for 16 years now, in reality, oftentimes it will take about, on a contested divorce, 50 hours. Usually that's all we get. If they were to go to a big firm, the Jones Days, the Tafts, the Squire Sanders, they would bill them by the hour, and that's it. And if you don't have the rest of your retainer, a motion to withdraw would be filed and probably granted. So this community is underserved because they can't go to certain firms and to certain lawyers, and we do have, usually solo practitioners have sympathy for these individuals because we know that they cannot pay at the hourly rate and basis that, you know, we deserve or whatever, but they can't afford it. But most of us truly and really do work with them anyway, and we stay on their cases and we litigate it as hard and as fast and as diligent as if we were to be getting the $350 an hour truly that the major firms do. And there is truly a need in the legal community for lawyers like that.
I appreciate that, and I'm impressed with the efforts of the Cleveland Bar Association to provide pro bono services and so forth to people that can't afford them. My concern is that when that statement is used for mitigation, I'm certain that it's not intended, and I'd like to hear somebody say this, it's not intended to suggest that an underserved population of people should not have lawyers, have access to lawyers whose standards, professional and discipline standards, are ethical standards are just as high as everyone else. Mm-hmm. Isn't that true? I mean, that's the mitigating part of this suggests that's not true, and I don't think that's right. That's not what you're suggesting, is it?
Not at all. But what I am kind of suggesting, and I do want the court to be aware of, it is a little tougher when you're a solo practitioner. Sure. Yes. To do things that the big firms don't, I hate to say get caught doing, but don't do. It's just our reality. But we're proud to do it, and we're happy to do it, and we'll keep doing it.
Okay. Some time for Mr. Maxton.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. You wish to take rebuttal, Mr. Maxton, rather than, okay. Ms. Mandel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Ellen Mandel on behalf of Relator. I'm here today with Lawrence Turbo, also on behalf of Relator. I would like to first address the court's inquiry with regard to the mitigating circumstance of serving an underserved population. I've always been offended by the concept that underserved people who can be most harmed by having an attorney who is not behaving within acceptable standards should somehow have less protection and that misconduct should be mitigating. Nobody is suggesting for a minute that a lawyer who's not being paid a sufficient amount of money should hire expensive experts if the client can't afford to do that, but that doesn't mean that the lawyer shouldn't behave ethically and appropriately. And when somebody who has only $200 to spend comes to an attorney and asks for something to be done, if the attorney accepts the responsibility to do it, then it's incumbent upon the attorney to actually do the work or to reject the case. In this particular circumstance, both with respect to the Crawford matter and the Thompson matter, there's no evidence in the files that any work was ever done.
Was restitution made in full to both of those?
Ultimately, early on in, once Mr. Poole had decided to cooperate and actually make an appearance in the case, he did send $200, which we forwarded on to Ms. Crawford. On the day of the hearing, in November of 2007, a check was presented for $1,000 from his IOLTA account. It was actually that check that created the presumption of an IOLTA violation of commingling, because he testified in response to one of the panel members' inquiries that he had put money in his IOLTA account so he could draft a check to repay Ms. Thompson. And I had confirmed her address, because there was some suggestion that they couldn't find her. And her address was exactly the same address it had always been. And we forwarded her the check, and she did receive it. I confirmed that. So there has been restitution, and that was one of the reasons why we had not recommended an even more severe sanction. I think it's incumbent upon the court to make a statement that while we state that protection of the public and not punishment is the paramount purpose of the disciplinary system, we have to remember that this is a self-regulating profession. And when you have evidence of an attorney who doesn't care enough to actually cooperate in the disciplinary process on more than one occasion, over and over again, without excuse, there has to be some actual time off. Otherwise, the system would fall apart. We couldn't be self-regulating if attorneys weren't sanctioned severely for not cooperating. In this particular case, the complaint, or the letters from the Lawyer-Client Relations Committee with respect to Dolores Crawford were sent to Mr. Poole in November of 2005. That was a month after, by the way, Ms. Thompson had hired him. It was also around that same time that the bankruptcy law was about to change, and Mr. Poole's testimony was that he took in a tremendous number of bankruptcy cases that all had to be filed by that deadline. And so he had a lot of bankruptcy work right around October 2005 and for the months thereafter, and that he didn't have any problems with those bankruptcy cases. But when he gets the letter from the Lawyer-Client Relations Committee, he ignores it. He ignores several letters from the Lawyer-Client Relations Committee, so it gets sent to the Grievance Committee. He ignores all of those letters. He ignores the letter that tells him we're referring it to Trial Committee. He ignores the letter that says this is the complaint we're about to file with the Board of Commissioners. He doesn't file an answer after the complaint is certified. We file a motion for default, and it isn't until a week later that he makes an appearance in the case. At that time, we already then have the Thompson matter, which we file separately and which are consolidated. During all of that period of time, he had opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to cooperate in the process, and he didn't.
Ms. Mandel, are you saying that it's really the lack of cooperation that is informing your recommendation here for an actual suspension?
Primarily correct. And I want to clarify, when I talk about lack of cooperation, it's not just merely showing up. It's actually being honest and forthright and displaying some level of candor to the investigator and then also ultimately to the trial committee.
Did the relator check into the issue of respondent's care for his mother at this period of time?
We'll take him at his word, and actually we didn't hear about that at any length until the trial. At deposition, we heard a number of things about some illnesses that he had, some personal illnesses, a couple of days of hospitalization. But we'll take him at his word that he was among the family members caring for his mother, but he was not the only family member caring for his mother. And during all of this time that he was supposed to be caring for his mother to the exclusion of everything else, he was maintaining this very active bankruptcy practice, which was telling to me that, and I by no means mean to diminish the level of stress upon him of having an elderly parent who was ill, but it's very convenient to be able to say, my mother was ill and I was caring for her, so I couldn't take care of these two cases, and I couldn't respond to the lawyer-client relations committee, and I couldn't respond to the grievance committee, but by the way, I was handling many, many bankruptcies.
There were no other complaints filed, is that correct?
There were none other, and I specifically inquired as to whether or not he successfully completed the bankruptcy cases or was sanctioned by the bankruptcy court. In the Northern District, we have a couple of judges who are very eager, not hesitant to sanction attorneys who don't comply with the time frames and the rules. And he testified that he had not been sanctioned, there had not been any problems, he had completed those cases successfully.
Yes, Ms. Mandel, unfortunately, we do have situations where attorneys may take the ostrich approach to notifications of disciplinary actions. And we have seen this before. Can you tell me, do we always impose an actual suspension when there's a failure to cooperate?
I can't say that you always do. I suspect that the court does not always, and I think I know the court does not always. However, when taken in conjunction with the number of times that there were an opportunity to cooperate and the number of times that there was an affirmative decision not to cooperate, and then couple that with the lack of candor while the case was pending after he did make an appearance, I think then the case law supports at least a six-month suspension. In this particular case, for example, a deposition, there's a whole colloquy about asking for IOLTA records. And there were two responses. One is I can't find them, and one is I have them, but I need to copy them. We never got them. There was an attempt to stipulate about the medical conditions, but nothing was forthcoming except some medical bills. I take them for what they are worth, that there were 4 or 5 days of hospitalization. But again, nothing that would have made it more feasible for us to have ameliorated our recommended sanction. We recommended a six-month suspension.
Why do you think the panel or the board went up to 2 years when you recommended only 6 months? What seemed to be the difference between
the difference,
that?
I believe, was Mr. Poole's conduct at the hearing.
But you didn't change your recommendation after the hearing, did you?
I probably should have. I think part of it was a little bit of compassion for what clearly was a very stressful situation for him. And I think because we got restitution of the $1,000 on the day of hearing, I didn't feel a need.
But I did ask the panel to
impose a six-month suspension with a requirement that he get some mental health care. And I think that was the reason why the board imposed a 2-year term and stayed 18 months, so that there could be some probationary period with monitoring. They didn't actually state what other conditions to probation would be in existence, but I would certainly hope that there be some mental health care.
Can you separate for me the ways in which the respondent failed to serve his clients and the ways in which he failed to respond properly to the discipline system?
Specifically factually?
Right.
He apparently told whoever it was that was related to the Crawford matter, whether it be the secretary in his office or Mrs. Crawford herself, who I think was the aunt of the secretary who gave him the $200, that there was a possibility that there was judicial release available. My understanding is that, in fact, judicial release was never an option in that case. So taking the money in the first place and giving people false hope, I think, was an improper way of serving that particular client. Ms. Thompson apparently had some lending problems, some potential foreclosure problems with respect to a couple of properties. By taking her money and not doing the work, there are a number of months there where she's not getting any assistance, where she's further in trouble. And when she tries to reach him, he tells her that, you know, there's a lot of research being done. We have a lot of research. We have, you know, great case. We're going forward with it. that happened in December. In January, she was fed up. She asked for her money back. And then so he had underserved her there. There was this delay of time of 3 or 4 months when work could have been done on her behalf. Negotiations could have been begun. A lawsuit could have been filed and wasn't. And then there was this dragging out of, I will give you $1,000 back. I'll give you $500 back when I get back from vacation. Until she finally filed a grievance because she couldn't get any response or any reimbursement. Then there were, I think I counted 7 or 8 letters total that were not responded to that came either from lawyer-client relations or the grievance committee on the Crawford and the Thompson matters combined before we actually got to filing the complaint. And a number of phone calls. And then the response that we got was not terribly responsive and not, frankly, forthcoming.
Do you see, as you know, I look, probably tell from what I've written, I look for dishonest motives or actions by lawyers. And I hope I don't find them, but I look for them in records when we get them, because oftentimes we find it. Here, it just seems to me that unless the taking of a fee when the client cannot really receive the benefit that the lawyer promises, or the holding of money, of a client's money, and dribbling it back to them when they should have received a refund, unless that's considered to be dishonest conduct, there's not a dishonest motive here that we oftentimes see in cases. Would you agree with that?
I do agree. In fact, we stipulated away the DR 1102A4 violation, and I still believe that the panel may have found something that wasn't there. I take, at least on face value, Mr. Poole's representation to Ms. Thompson that he would write her a check for $500. I have no way of proving or any reason to disbelieve that when he made that statement to her, he intended to do it. I have no reason to believe that when he took her $1,000 that he didn't intend to do the work. But it became very quickly apparent to him that he wasn't doing the work. And then he lied to her. I think because she got the money back, that one misrepresentation that we've done a lot of work on your case doesn't rise to the level of being sanctionable. But it's not honest. It's just not dishonest enough to be sanctioned. And that's why we stipulated it away.
There's no allegation, I guess, of commingling of funds here either, although apparently there's evidence that there was not $1,000 left in the escrow account, even at the time he indicated that he would return part of that fee. But that was not charged in this case, is that correct?
Well, the testimony was that he used his IOLTA account as his personal checking account. The problem that we had in this case in terms of that particular violation is that his testimony at deposition was that, at least with respect to Crawford and Thompson, these were flat fee cases. So I didn't have an IOLTA violation to charge. I believe the panel and then ultimately the board was concerned because he testified he put money in his IOLTA account to write the check to Ms. Thompson that he brought to the hearing, and that in and of itself constituted commingling. And I think his representation was he believed that he had to write the refund check out of his IOLTA account even if the money wasn't there. So we had asked for his IOLTA records at deposition. We did not get them. Because this had been delayed so much, we weren't going to delay the trial any further. That theoretically is something for another day. If
Thank
there's
you,
nothing
Ms.
further, thank you.
Mr. Maxson, you have 2 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, Court. Ms. Mandale, and I think the Justice had indicated, I think the Chief Justice had indicated, why is it that the serving an underserved community should mitigate? And Judge, I think it goes to the heart of the person who does that. We are in a profession where people are making $250,000, $350,000, $400,000 a year, Your Honor. When you decide to serve in a community where you're barely making a living, it speaks to your motivation, it speaks to the kind of person you are, the heart that you have within you. So I think what we're doing is saying people who do that need to be given a break. You don't have the resources that a firm would have. You don't have investigators, clerks, payroll clerks, research assistants. You usually don't have that. I think it's significant in this case that Mr. Poole has 30 years of service, two complaints very quickly together during a period in which there are at least supportable allegations. He had medical problems. His mother died. There's not an allegation his mother was sick. His mother died. There is. He was in Cleveland Clinic Hospital. They still don't know what's wrong with Mr. Poole. And this all happened during that period of time. I think that's extremely significant. 30 years, then two incidents within a very compact short of time while these medical conditions are going on.
Mr. Maxton, are you stating that the medical conditions were the reasons for the failure to cooperate? Because as we listen to Ms. Mandel, that seems to be the real reason that they are requesting the actual suspension.
Judge, Your Honor, I think that in the hearing before the board, it was on the record that Mr. Poole was suffering from very severe depression problems, which he had been in denial about. Under the circumstances, even if you call it situational depression, Mr. Poole was not himself. And I think Ms. Mandel mentioned that she was concerned about the fact that he did bankruptcies okay, but in this expungement situation and this mortgage situation, all of a sudden he was not functional. I think the reason for that is bankruptcy law is very paperwork, is pro forma. You just sit down, you fill out the forms, you show up. And I think he could manage that at that time. I don't think at that time he was really able to do the kind of law that would have required him to think quickly and respond in a way that criminal law would.
What counsel, did he have a secretary?
No, Your Honor, as far as I know, he did not have a secretary.
So he was
not a personal secretary. I think he was on an office sharing arrangement in which the secretary would have been shared by about six or seven people. He did not have a personal secretary.
Okay. A well-trained?
No.
Secretary could keep a lot of the bankruptcy and stuff going.
And Judge, that goes once again to the idea of serving underserved communities. A well-trained legal secretary costs a lot of money. Okay. People.
But in other words, that doesn't explain how he kept the forms flowing. And
the secretary didn't keep the forms flowing. Mr. Poole himself kept the forms flowing by himself.
Mr. Maxton, you suggested that your client might suffer from some depression. Is there anywhere in the record that's supported or that he has received treatment for that or ongoing treatment?
Judge, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that he's receiving treatment for that. He has made contact with OLAP at this point. Mr. Poole, in the record, and I think at the board, it was pointed out Mr. Poole has been in very serious denial about his depression problem. This is why we also thought that in terms of the recommendation for discipline for Mr. Poole, that what we think should have happened is Mr. Poole should have been ordered to receive support services, maybe some type of monitoring from an experienced attorney while he received the appropriate mental health treatment. And we think that would have been what would have been appropriate under these circumstances rather than an active suspension, which would do nothing but make the clients he already has suffer. And remember that this is an underserved community that he serves. These people are not going to be able to go to Jones Day, Climaco, and say, can you take my case? They're not going to be able to do that.
Thank you, Mr.
Well, but Mr. Maxson, let me challenge you that at the risk of offending. It seems to me that we need to look at this from the side, from the viewpoint, not just of the lawyer, but of the clients. And it seems to me if we do what you're suggesting we do, even if we put this in, I wrote down, lawyers need to be given a break who are serving the underserved community. But that's a different standard than we provide for everyone else. And it doesn't seem to me that it's only the lawyers in Jones Day, to use that as a symbolic figure, who need to respond to their clients promptly, to return phone calls, who need to take fees for work that they believe they can. I mean, in the underserved community, it's that $200 means far more to that person who gave it to your client than $1,000 may mean to somebody who gives it to somebody in a large firm. And so
that's correct,
my concern is if we do what you are suggesting we do, we're going to have a double standard for professionalism and the application of disciplinary rules to
Your Honor,
lawyers.
I think that you're correct. And in Mr. Poole's situation, I think it should be noted that in 30 years, and you will find this, solo practitioners who have practiced for 20, 30 years, one error. Mr. Poole is accused of two errors with a total value of about $400 in a 30-year career.
Well, I agree. He's far from the worst we've seen here,
He has not provided lower-level services, nor do most private practitioners. However, there is a constant struggle to provide those services. It is not rewarded, is not compensated, and in a situation where in a 30-year career you make two mistakes, to be put out of business, and that's essentially what a six-month active suspension would do. His clients would not get served during that period. His practice would be gone. Okay. Now, I think one justice asked about the ostrich approach by attorneys. That's also common to depression. Depression frequently makes the sufferer hide from his problem. I think in one of the depositions, on the original deposition with Mandel, she asked, why didn't you respond? He said, I got the letters. I just couldn't deal with it. That's typical of depression, Your Honor.
Did you sum up, Mr. Maxson?
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.